Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, what refugees endure in their attempts to reach safety in Europe and why so many of them don't make it. We'll spend this hour with Dr. Seema Jilani, a pediatrician who has volunteered on humanitarian aid ships that trawl the Mediterranean looking for endangered travelers. We'll talk about the complicated international politics that force asylum seekers to travel by a dangerous route and about why some NGOs are pulling out of the Mediterranean. And we'll hear the stories of some of the people who believe a potentially deadly sea crossing beats remaining in Syria, Egypt, or Sudan. Our conversation starts after a short break. The headlines about refugees pouring into Europe from troubled parts of the Middle East and North Africa have subsided a bit here in the U.S., but don't let that mislead you. People are still leaving Syria, Egypt, Sudan, and other troubled places by the thousands, preparing to cross the Mediterranean into Europe or die trying. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. More than 15,000 would-be migrants have lost their lives between Libya and Italy since 2014. But as we'll learn, the danger is not limited to the hazards of a challenging sea voyage in a substandard boat. Dr. Seema Jilani is a pediatrician and a humanitarian aid volunteer. She's worked in Afghanistan, Iraq, Gaza, Egypt, Sudan, Nepal, and the Balkans. Her essay, What Refugees Face on the World's Deadliest Migration Route, appeared last month in the New York Times Magazine. She joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington to talk about it. Seema, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You were there in November, 30 miles off the Libyan coast. What was the weather like?
Off the Libyan coast, you're never quite very cold, but given that you are in water, one of the things we were worried about is seeing refugees coming off of their rickety boats with hypothermia in that weather. So that's one of the considerations that, as a physician, I had to take into account. And during the daytime, it would be sunny, but of course, at night, it does get very chilly out in those waters in particular.
You described the boat that you were on as a kind of dystopian Noah's Ark. That's quite an image.
It was. It really was. You know, I've been in Afghanistan and Iraq, and I've done aid work throughout the world. But this was particularly different and particularly striking for a couple of reasons. The first one is by the time you rescue these families, and for us on the first rescue out, we rescued 423 souls and were also carrying the body of a young woman who died at sea. So amongst these 400 plus refugees, you had people from every corner of the world, as you mentioned, between women and children from Syria, Morocco, Algeria, people who had crossed the Sahara, Eritrea, Somalia, a paraplegic gentleman, elderly gentleman, teenagers, unaccompanied minors. Any pocket of humanity that you can think of was represented on that boat. And because we were traveling with them for almost 2 days, if I were in Kabul working at a hospital, I would go and work all day and then come home to my apartment or whatnot, my bed, and sleep in my own bed. But this was something so different that you, in a way that you really bonded with the refugees. You were eating the same food, sleeping in the same area. Certainly we had our own barracks and rooms, but, you know, in very close quarters for very long periods of time. And I think that's what made it different. And the sheer volume of people, where you were literally walking over people in order to attend to the sickest of the sick, was quite extraordinary.
And you were the only doctor on board?
I was. I had one nurse with me, but I was the only doctor on board for 423 people.
Wow. The distance between Libya and Sicily is not all that far. What makes the voyage so dangerous?
Well, if we kind of step back from the situation for a little bit, we're currently in the crisis of a generation where the number of displaced persons is the highest it's been since World War II. And that includes refugees, asylum seekers, internally displaced people. And that is quite an extreme figure when you think about it. And what makes it perilous, that journey, well, first of all, there were many journeys a few years ago to get to Europe from these troubled nations. One of the more trafficked ones used to be going from Turkey to Greece, which was indeed a shorter route through the Mediterranean. And after Turkey and Greece struck a deal whereby Turkey would receive several million dollars in order to squash the flow of refugees into Europe, that has all but ended. Those refugee treks have ended. Then there was the overland journey from the Caucasus or Eastern Europe via Hungary and then Macedonia through the Balkans, trying to get into Western Europe. I'm sure many of your listeners and you, Chris, are familiar with the images, you know, the harrowing images that we saw of people trying to cross borders there, tens of thousands of people trying. And now that governments are changing and increasingly more sort of right-leaning politicians have been elected, most recently in Hungary and Italy, that route has been definitely quelled. So what's left now is the Libya to usually Italy or Libya across the Mediterranean. And what makes that journey so dangerous is many of the bigger aid organizations have stopped working there as a result of danger, and we can talk a little bit about how that occurred, but danger to their own personnel. And that includes Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, or Doctors Without Borders, and Save the Children, amongst others, which pulled out of the Mediterranean officially in an official capacity last year. And so what is left? What's left on the seas, on the high seas, when you think about that? That leaves human traffickers. That leaves absolutely desperate people that will trade money, sometimes their own bodies, send their children unaccompanied just to get out of absolutely desperate situations across the seas. So, you know, I was scared as a grown adult woman on a fairly large boat, it was a 150-foot boat, looking out into the black darkness of the Mediterranean at night, and there's not a soul in sight. I cannot imagine what it would be like to get into a leaky dinghy or raft, inflatable raft or wooden boat, and have to get 20 some odd miles off the coast of Libya, because that's the journey, that's how far you have to get reach international waters, and do that with your child. I cannot imagine what kind of desperation that entails. So then once you get out onto the seas, then you risk drowning, of course. Over approximately 3,000 people die in the Mediterranean every year. So when you think about that, that's the equivalent of, you know, a 9/11 happening in the Mediterranean Sea every year. So you are risking your life just on the high seas. And then add that you are exposed to all sorts of diseases, all sorts of communicable diseases. Hypothermia in this case was a big concern. Actual damage from boats, you know, from the diesel in the boat burn. You know, one of the big problems we look for is diesel that burns the feet. And so that's just a little taste of what, and, you know, and this is all banking on finding a rescue boat. And if you don't find a rescue boat, then that's the end of your story there in the Mediterranean. You end up as one of those 3,000 people, 3,000 bodies.
So if I understand you correctly, it's almost like people set off and they don't even think that the watercraft that they're in could possibly make the entire journey. They're hoping to run into a rescue boat.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, the story that you read about in the New York Times that I wrote, that was the first leg of our journey. Once we dropped those refugees in Augusta, Sicily, the port of destination that was given to us by the Maritime Center from Rome, we actually set back out on another journey and another patrol, which would be our second one in the Mediterranean, to look for more. And it is quite, if you allow me a little bit of time, I can tell you this. The most intriguing part of this story was, so we broke kind of two records on this trip. The first one, for this NGO at least, was the most refugees rescued, which was 423. And on the second leg, which I'll tell you about now, it was the least. So we were out for 2 days in what we call the SAR zone, which is S-A-R, Safety and Rescue Zone, which is approximately 20 miles off the coast of Libya, in international waters. And we had waited and waited and looking out onto the sea, waiting for calls from the Maritime Center. Sometimes the Maritime Center in Rome will say there's a boat in distress and give us the coordinates. And nothing was showing up. Nothing was popping up, which was very bizarre because the weather was good. So when we followed the news, oftentimes it's linked to political issues. We had realized that at that time, the head of state of Libya was meeting with President Trump in Washington, D.C., and this had frightened the migrants and refugees from leaving the coast. So that, it's so interesting when people often think this is an isolated case or how does this affect me? This is one example of how the West really affects creates a domino effect. So refugees were not leaving because they were very afraid of hearing this political news and they were afraid of being shot at sea. So what ended up happening is we had our lifeguard. We were actually going to leave. And our nurse said, let's just wait just another hour. Let's just see what pops up. And our lifeguard looks into his binoculars and he says, I think I see the thread of a silhouette of someone. He calls two people to look in his binoculars, both of them on our crew, and said, no, I don't think so. That's not anything. The third person said, you know, that might just be something. We pull up. It's a lone Syrian refugee in a tiny inflatable raft who is just buoyantly floating in the Mediterranean, preying upon, you know, hoping on hope that somebody will find him. And that was the record that we broke for the least number of refugees. So we rescued 423 and one dead body. And then on the second go around, we rescued one. So it is pretty extraordinary. And excuse me, but just to backtrack when you asked with the dangers of the on sea, you have Libyan militias out on the sea and the Libyan Coast Guard. I mean, let's be honest, the Libyan Coast Guard is largely a fractured group of Libyan militants. And they are now firing under the direction and being provided by intelligence and funding from the EU and Italy in particular to stop the flow of migrants. They are now firing upon aid workers, which is why MSF and Save the Children pulled out.
One of your patients on the trip in which you saved 423 people was a 15-year-old boy. You weren't initially sure that he would survive the night, and he was all alone.
Yeah. I can't imagine. I mean, I have a 2-year-old daughter, and if I just think of the absolute human tragedy that family must have gone through and total desperation to send their child. And by the way, he was not the only unaccompanied minor. One of the jobs we have as physicians is to certify all the unaccompanied minors and to make sure to point them out to the Italian authorities once we land at port so that they can direct them to social services. This young man was a 15-year-old man who kept just telling me and holding my hand, and he was in the throes of hypothermia. His eyes were rolling back on the deck, and it was, you know, if you can imagine the waves crashing onto the deck, and this, you know, I say young man, but he was really just a boy. 15 is just a boy, and just kept saying, you know, tell my family, please tell my family. And you just felt his youth and his naivete and his innocence in that moment, and that he didn't realize what he had gotten himself into. But I also think of his mother, to think that she was sending him for a better life, you know. And so some of the things they're fleeing include rape, authoritarian regimes, poverty, famine, slavery, female genital mutilation, and then, you know, people who are LGBTQ, who are fleeing countries that are oppressive to their lifestyle.
My guest is pediatrician Dr. Seema Jalani. She's a humanitarian aid volunteer who's written an essay that appeared last month in the New York Times Magazine called What Refugees Face on the World's Deadliest Migration Route. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or go to Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. We'll return in about 2 minutes. Thank you. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with humanitarian aid volunteer Dr. Seema Jalani. She's a pediatrician who has worked all over the world. Recently, she wrote about writing about being on a salvage boat in the Mediterranean, trying to pull people from the waters on the trip from Libya to Italy. The piece in the New York Times Magazine is called What Refugees Face on the World's Deadliest Migration Route. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. So the EU struck a deal last year with Libya in hopes of reducing the flow of migrants into Europe. What were the terms of that agreement?
So, yes, exactly. So the EU, and in particular Italy, struck a deal to try and squash any flow of migrants. And so by default, the Libyan Coast Guard has become Europe's gatekeepers for refugees. Now, Italy provides intelligence, funding, and even some of their old boats and training as well as arms to the Libyan Coast Guard. And what I mean by the Libyan Coast Guard is actually a fractured group of militias who are now running the Libyan government. Certainly not a Coast Guard that we would think of as a safe people who are there to ensure safety. And instead of allowing safe passage of refugees through the Mediterranean, the Libyan Coast Guard now fires upon aid groups. They actually impersonate aid groups now and will, quote unquote, rescue migrants and refugees who are crossing. And once they're returned to these boats, they're actually in the care of Libyan militias and have been videotaped in beating them. And so essentially this means that Europe is in bed with the Libyan Coast Guard and in a quest to seal their borders, international law is no longer being followed, because according to international law, if there are refugees in a body of water, they deserve and have the right to be taken to the nearest safe port. And the nearest safe port is not Tripoli, Libya, but it would be somewhere in Europe, most likely Italy or Sicily. So the Libyan Coast Guard is doing the dirty work for the EU, preventing refugees to come to the Europe shores. And so this is a problem because it's criminalizing the work that I'm doing. So it's criminalizing aid workers. Aid workers are being shot at. And it becomes a very, very dangerous situation. We're repatriating these people back to slavery, in modern day slavery.
So that definition, nearest safe port, it doesn't only refer to the nearest physically safe port in which to land a boat. It's also talking about the reasonable expectation of safety for the people disembarking.
Absolutely.
Okay. You report that the Libyan Coast Guard, such as it is, not a professionalized group, threatened to kill the crew of the very ship that you volunteered on, although it happened after you had left.
Yes. So 2 months ago, about 2 months ago, the boat that I had been working on with some of the same crew members and the same captain, the Libyan Coast Guard stopped them in international waters, which again is illegal, threatened to kill the crew of the name of the group is Proactiva Open Arms, and that's the ship that I volunteered on. And this was in international waters. They threatened to kill them if they didn't turn over the refugees on board. The crew refused. In a very noble act and endangering their own safety. They refused. They had women and children on board. They said they couldn't live with themselves if they were to turn over the women and children to Libyan militias and human smugglers. And once they reached land in Italy, the Italian police officers closed in, impounded the boat for approximately 1 month, and placed the captain and the head of mission under investigation, which is still continuing, and have accused them of facilitating human trafficking. Their only crime was rescuing 218 refugees from a dinghy in the Mediterranean Sea.
What is the motivation of the Libyan Coast Guard for being so abusive to the individuals who are stranded at sea?
You know, that would get into a lot of internal politics that in terms of what is happening in Libya right now. And several months ago, I believe it was CNN who broke the story regarding modern-day slavery, where people in Libya, particularly African migrants, are being sold for as little as $400, literally on auction blocks. I am glad that I cannot speak to the motivations of the Libyans, of the Libyan militia. I don't know.
Yeah, no, and forgive me, I wasn't trying to imply that you could understand it.
Not at all.
It just it is hard to fathom that it just seems almost arbitrarily violent.
Well, they are getting, well, this was the purpose of the, Chris, this was the, you nailed it. This is the purpose of the agreement. They're getting funding, they're getting arms, they're getting boats from Italy and the EU, so it works well for them.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Dana on the line in Plano. Hi, Dana.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I wanted to, first of all, thank Dr. Jelani for her volunteer work. I did some volunteer work last year in Serbia and Hungary with Afghan and Iranian refugees, and it's very heartbreaking, first of all, because I think many of us who live in relative comfort wonder why these people would make the trek. And then when you get there and you see that some of them question their own humanity when they're crossing the Mediterranean and they see people falling into the sea and wonder why they don't jump in to help them. They see mothers jumping in after their children. Or as one man told me, he said, I had 5 children when I left and I have 4 because one is somewhere in the mountains in the snow. We just couldn't carry him anymore.
Ugh.
And so it just is heartbreaking unless you've seen it and experienced it. And but I do appreciate the work that you're doing.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. And thank you for your work.
How do you keep going emotionally, Sigma, when you've, you know, experienced the kind of, you know, horror stories akin to what Dana just described?
I look to those refugees. I look to them as a source of strength. And that's how they are a fountain of seemingly never-ending strength and humanity. And I see, and you mentioned Rafiq, the 15-year-old boy who's sitting there clamoring in my arms for life and just wants to hold someone's hand in the darkness. And I actually get strength from their strength. I also take comfort in the fact that I'm very privileged. I get to get on a plane and come back to America where I am able to hug my daughter, and I hopefully will never have to face the choice of having to send her out as an accompanied minor for a better life.
Did Rafiq survive the night?
He did. He did. And when we saw the Italian coastline coming up, it was such a mix of emotions for all of us. You see this beautiful Sicilian coastline coming up upon the sea, and the entire boat started breaking out in song and dance, and they, you know, were throwing up their blankets in hurrah, and it was beautiful. And he looked at me, and in this like beautiful magical moment, just gave me 2 thumbs up. And I was very conflicted in that moment, because yes, I was so hopeful for them, but I also know that's not the end of the road. That's just the beginning of another chapter. Some of them will be detained. Some of them will be repatriated back after that long journey. Some of them face xenophobia and racism. And so it's just the beginning of another chapter. And I was very conflicted.
You also took care of a baby that was just a little over a month old on that trip.
Yeah, it's not uncommon. It's the I think 2 trips prior to mine, there was a baby born on the boat.
Wow.
Can you imagine? There was a baby born on the boat. And you just think, you know, anybody who's a mom out there or has ever taken care of a mom, what the woman's body is going through postnatally and to get onto a boat, that is not an easy feat. And this little baby was covered in lesions. You know, they had really bad scabies. But also the mom was just a first-time mom. And this is the humanity in us all. You know, she was just trying to figure out being a mom, just like anybody else would be. You know, we look at these horrific photos sometimes of refugees, and it's almost otherizing them. But they're really just like our friends and family. She was trying to figure out how to breastfeed and just needed help with that. That's like any first-time mom. You know, the dad wanted to change the baby's diaper every 30 minutes because he was a new dad, you know? and so the baby did all right. I don't know what's in their future. I really don't. But all I can say, you know, I hope that it's better, and I think that it's better than whatever they left behind.
When we hear a story told from the perspective that you're telling it here, the perspective of these really desperate refugees, it's almost impossible not to empathize with them. Sometimes the story is told from the perspective of these overwhelmed destination countries and communities, and it's hard not to empathize with them. Where the conversation rarely goes is to the countries of origin and what might be done to improve conditions there. Is that just something we've had to give up on?
That is a great, great question. Well, first of all, the vast majority of refugees do not go to wealthy countries. And I think that's a little bit of a misconception. For instance, if you take a look at Syrian refugees, Turkey has taken upwards of 2.5 million. Lebanon has taken upwards of 1.5 million, and Jordan also. So those are the three big ones that take in Syrian refugees. They are not rich countries, and they are dealing with their own problems. And the same thing with Afghanistan, and Pakistan has taken upwards of 1.5 million. So I, you know, a lot of these countries have authoritarian regimes, and particularly in the wake of the Arab Spring, have become these fractured governments. But certainly, we can't deny that the West and Europe and America have certainly played a part in a large part of the world's conflict, in particular in the refugee crisis. So,
how do you communicate with patients who don't share a common language with you?
You know, the language of humanity and love and sometimes motherhood and actually being a pediatrician is very helpful because kids don't communicate to you what's hurting. And so oftentimes it's, you know, I actually speak Urdu and Hindi, which is the same spoken. We had someone that spoke French on board. That was very helpful. But it just being able to tap into a lot of it is facial expressions and also being culturally aware that maybe a mom or a woman might have something private to tell you, you know. I mean, this was to the point where we were handing out sanitary pads, and that's not something that people always feel comfortable. So they might take you aside and say, you know, I need something that women only need, you know, almost speaking in code.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is pediatrician and humanitarian aid volunteer Dr. Seema Jalani. We're talking about her essay, What Refugees Face on the World's Deadliest Migration Route. It appeared last month in the New York Times Magazine. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You mentioned speaking Urdu and Hindi. This work is personal to you in a way. Your grandfather had to flee India after the partition because he was Muslim.
Yes, yes. So, you know, the partition is such a an impotent word for what it was, and that's what it's called. You're correct. That's exactly what it's called. But a million people died in the creation of Pakistan and in fighting for independence of India from Britain. And my family hailed from Hyderabad, which was an independent province within India. And he left in the middle of the night, my grandfather and my father's side, with basically a knapsack. That's the classic story you hear. He fled northward and then sent for the rest of the family. So he reached Karachi, lived in refugee camps. And then the rest of the family, including my dad, who was a toddler at the time, fled on a boat the exact same way. So it was so haunting to see these people. Again, we tend to otherize them and think they're some foreigners when in fact, to me, it felt like this could have been the path of my dad. I saw a toddler. I thought that was the age my dad was on this boat. You know, my dad then ended up migrating to England and then thereafter to America, where he's a proud American, a proud Texan, actually, wears a belt buckle and boots every day and worked for KBR for 30 years. So that's kind of the American dream. But it didn't have to be that way. They could have ended up as bodies haunting the Mediterranean and kind of, you know, bloated, you know, ghosts on the Mediterranean. But so I am the daughter and a granddaughter of refugees. So it was very personal.
How was that story passed down in your family? Was it something that you didn't fully understand until you got old enough to think about it in a really serious way?
This is a very great question. So it was never spoken about because it was never until I got married, and I actually married a white American gentleman. And I think that my grandparents and my parents wanted to start carrying down and passing down that tradition of where did we come from. And it wasn't until then that they started talking to us about, you know, this is what happened, and the stories that would come out. My father was almost kidnapped on the docks of Karachi, you know, who came and who left, and so many family members in India that are left behind that we have no contact with anymore. And so we weren't told. So, you know, it was a shameful thing to be a refugee, and it has a stigma. I didn't know until maybe 2 years ago that my grandfather was in a refugee camp. And I'm 37 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but I think now, I don't know why they share that, maybe just to pass along some history.
Have you been curious to look up what the conditions were like in the camps that he stayed in?
Yes, I have not found any information. So if any of your good listeners are tapped into the partition and what happened then, and I haven't been able to track it down. But I do know that my grandfather, who made that journey and then sent for the rest of the family, he ended up speaking, I think, 5 or 6 languages, ended up working for the WHO and the United Nations and really building a life for himself. So I want people and your listeners to understand that these are people that are really willing to work and work hard to contribute to the greater good.
Yeah, like there's resiliency and potential in these people if they can just survive the current moment.
Absolutely, absolutely.
My guest is humanitarian aid volunteer and pediatrician Dr. Seema Jalani. She's got an essay that appeared last month in the New York Times Magazine called What Refugees Face on the World's Deadliest Migration Route. It's, of course, about the journey across the Mediterranean from Libya to the coast of Sicily or Italy. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or go to Twitter and leave a question there. We are at KERA Think. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is pediatrician Dr. Seema Jalani, a humanitarian aid volunteer who wrote an essay recently for the New York Times Magazine called What Refugees Face on the World's Deadliest Migration Route. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Forgive me for asking what seems like a grisly question, but 15,000 would-be migrants have lost their lives on the Mediterranean since 2014. What happens to all the bodies, Seema?
They remain in the Mediterranean. You know, I'm so proud of our organization, which is Proactiva Open Arms, where if we lose somebody on the journey, then we take it upon ourselves that, you know, we believe that humans deserve dignity in life and dignity in death. And so it would be so easy just to kind of throw them overboard into the sea. But we actually, you know, put them in properly ventilated medical body bags and then transport them to Italy. Now what happens to the ones at sea is they just die at sea. Some, you know, and there were a few years ago, I think now, photos of them washing up, the juxtaposition of European beaches and sungoers with bodies washing up onto the shore is so striking. And so I imagine we'll be seeing more of that if this continues.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Malia in McKinney. Hi, Malia.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Love your show. Dr. Jalani, I'm just calling in to thank you for everything that you do. You're a brave, brave woman. And my question is, what made you take that step where, you know, you're a mother, you're a pediatrician, you're a busy woman. You actually stepped out of your life into this very heart-wrenching, dangerous world to do what you do.
Thank you so much for your kind words. Because I have to. I think that when I heard about, I've been wanting to do this actually for quite some time, for 2 years or so, but then I was pregnant and then I had the baby and I couldn't do it. But I feel as if I am exquisitely trained for this. This is what I'm meant to do. And if I'm not doing this, then I'm not sure what I am supposed to be doing. You know, I think it's a part of my DNA. Mm-hmm. And I did. This is the first time I was away from my daughter. So I did have second thoughts. And finally, it was my husband that said, this is who you are. You have to do this. And not just despite having a family and a child, but because of it. So when she grows up, she can see, you know, the photo of myself and Rafiq, who I talked about earlier, the 15-year-old boy, or myself and the little baby who was on board, and say, hey, that was my mom. And that's what's important to me.
You were working aboard a converted salvage tugboat. Can you describe for us this watercraft and how Proactiva Open Arms sort of found it and converted it into something that could be used for these purposes?
Sure. It is not glamorous, but it does the job. Let's see. It has several cabins aboard for the crew. We have lifeguards on board, a captain, a head of mission, a cook, a nurse, a doctor, and then engineers. And so we have the deck, which, you know, and consider that anything that happens or occurs on board, you know, I was also the doctor for the crew. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, we would help clean up after the refugees had left. We would wash down the deck and the boat. So there's a large deck and also the bridge up top where the captain hangs out and guides the boat and is constantly fielding calls from Italy and Spain and their maritime centers. There's two refugee bathrooms for over 400 people on board. And the deck, the refugees are not in closed quarters. They're out in the open, although we try our best to shield them from the elements. It's a boat on the sea, so they are still very much out in the open. And then because I was working in the wintertime and we were dealing with hypothermia, we would take the people who were closest to death or intensive care and put them in the workshop, and even thought about putting them in the engine room when both of those are the warmest places on deck, on the ship. And then when I talked about, if, you know, with the diesel, often in the boats that they're fleeing in, the diesel will go onto their legs and burn them. So you'll have oozing sort of blood coming from their feet oftentimes. And you can imagine the absolute worst nightmare for a boat like that, or any boat in the sea, is fire for both us and for them. So imagine getting 400 some odd refugees, the majority of whom are covered in diesel. So the first job we have to do is wash off all of the diesel, change their clothes, and wash them for at least 10 minutes, at least the gasoline. So we have to carry an enormous amount of water with us as well.
So these are chemical burns from the diesel, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, I want to go back to the phones now. We have Marilyn calling in Dallas. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello. Hi, Seema.
Hi, Marilyn.
I'm Marilyn, Leslie's mom.
Oh,
and
hi.
We were so excited about your trip and followed you, and of course we got emails from your family. I wanted to ask, what about the children who had been separated from their parents in the previous steps of this trek that they were taking?
Right.
Were there a lot of children who were really traumatized, and what age were these children?
Yeah, so, first of all, thanks for calling in, Marilyn. And the children ranged from, I think, 3 weeks upwards to 21 years. Unaccompanied minors that we had were somewhere about 30 to 40, at least, if I remember correctly. And so we alert the Italian authorities to them. But you can imagine, in this type of chaotic situation when we're docking, that they, some of them, I imagine, get lost in the fray. I shudder to think that some of them, obviously we have human trafficking is a big problem, particularly in the refugee population. So they've all been traumatized in one way or another, whether they've been sold or tortured or raped, boys and girls, kept in deplorable conditions. So this is, and you could see, you know, anytime there was a loud noise on the boat, or maybe the boat had a wave that was crashing up on it, I could definitely tell as a trained physician who was suffering from PTSD, and it was a large majority of people there. That would shudder with a loud noise or take cover, particularly the Syrian refugees as well, that had been through so much. And so I hope that some of them will never be reunited with their families. And that's, the families knew that when they put them on that boat. And some of them, you know, if they can go to a processing center, hopefully they might be reunited.
The adults who are probably equally traumatized, they recognize that reaching the Italian or Sicilian shoreline is just the next step in their journey. How realistic are they about the possibility that they might well be turned away?
Yeah, so some of them were, I think they know, I think word gets around in the refugee communities is, you know, this is just the beginning. It's the beginning of another chapter. The Syrian refugee, his name was Sami, who I spoke about earlier, the lone Syrian refugee that we rescued, who was in this inflatable raft, 20 miles off the coast of Libya and had just been hiding out there for 23 some odd hours waiting for us. We dropped him in Lampedusa, and we transferred him to another refugee agency who then dropped him in Lampedusa. He was trying to see his girlfriend, who was also a refugee, who he had not seen in 4 years. And he thought, oh man, I've reached Lampedusa in Italy. And I'm a Syrian refugee. I have my passport with me. He's supposed to have protected rights, particularly as a Syrian refugee. He ended up being detained for 6 weeks there in Lampedusa, and he would text me and say, I didn't risk my life to come across the Mediterranean just to die here in Lampedusa in Italy, and I need to get out. And he was absolutely desperate. His another person that was detained with him from Tunisia actually committed suicide in that. So like, this is the beginning of a new chapter. It's not the end. Afterward, he then traveled from Sicily to Rome to Milan to France to Germany, and where Germany is where he's at now. And he's still fighting. He's still fighting to get to his girlfriend.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. When you have a group of desperate people who originated in Tunisia and Egypt and Sudan and Syria, do they sort of come together across national barriers when they are in this shared situation of desperation? Do you see people sort of huddling with their fellow countrymen?
A little bit of both. Mm-hmm. I think they definitely, as in terms of having a shared culture and a shared language, people tend to find their own countrymen. Then again, when I talk about the new mother that was on board with her newborn baby and the families, it was so beautiful to see this representation of almost in a feminist way, where these women were looking out for the women and looking out for children and helping the new mom across language barrier, across religion. Remember, there are lots of Christians and people and Muslims and all sorts of religions. And so people were really branching out. If somebody needed something, people were very, and that's another thing. Someone asked me, where do you get that strength from? You know, I could complain all day long, but here's somebody who has nothing, who's ready to give up the one blanket that they have for their neighbor that they've never met. And that's pretty incredible. And you did see that kind of generosity on board.
I'll tell you what's hard for me, and I've tried to do this as a privileged American. It's hard to imagine how bad things would have to get for me to send my children unaccompanied or to take them on a trip when they were very small that I thought they might not survive because it's physically dangerous. Have you thought about like how bad things would have to get for you to make a choice like that?
I try not to, but you're right. I try not to. I think about my grandfather, and as I was writing the piece for the New York Times, I had to do a little bit more of digging and asking what exactly happened. So apparently my grandfather left as a refugee from India to Pakistan. He left behind a vial of poison in case things got so bad that he couldn't send for his wife and children. That's pretty dark. That's pretty grim. And if you think about total human desperation and that's what it would get to, then I imagine it would have to be really bad to set foot on this journey. When the sea and the water and the depths of despair like that are better than what you're leaving behind, imagine what these people have left behind, whether it's, and some of them, when you cross the Sahara, there are human traffickers and human smugglers who, you're risking rape, you're risking your life, you're risking, and consider that many of these people were even the privileged of those refugees where they had to pay. These trips do not come cheap or free. They probably had to pay several hundred dollars to get on the boat, to get them out to sea in the first place. So it's a level of total human desperation that I cannot imagine.
So it's physically a much longer journey, but the United States has a really pretty successful track record of successfully integrating refugees from a lot of different parts of the world. What do you think explains the resistance in this current moment to making space for more people who desperately need a safe place to live?
I think that this administration, and we're having a moment in this country, and the administration has tapped in to human pain, and people want someone to blame for that. And then the easiest person to blame is the person on down the totem pole, and those would be the refugees or the newcomers. It's not anything new. This happened with Irish Americans. It happened with, I think, General John Kelly made a statement about immigrants not assimilating a few weeks ago. I believe his family was Irish American, and there was a really great fact finder, someone on Twitter, that had dug up ancestry and said, his ancestors actually didn't speak English either, and we can all track down those records and see that we're all immigrants in this country, and that's what makes America so fantastic, as opposed to even Europe, where they don't really have the legacy of immigration, but we were really founded and built on that legacy, and that's what makes us successful in refugee and migrant assimilation. And I can take my own personal story. My dad is a proud Texan. He was just featured in National Geographic as an Elvis impersonator because, and because for him, Elvis meant everything American and free, and he just, before 9/11 ever happened, we had the American flag outside of our house every day, and he would take it down if it rained because he didn't want it to get soiled. And that's the kind of Americans that we are. And, yes, we're grateful, but we also feel that we also earned our place here.
Dr. Seema Jalani is a pediatrician humanitarian aid volunteer who has worked in Afghanistan, Iraq, Gaza, Egypt, Sudan, Nepal, and the Balkans, also the Mediterranean. Her recent essay appeared in the New York Times Magazine. It's called What Refugees Face on the World's Deadliest Migration Route. Seema, thank you so much for making time to speak with us.
I really want to thank you, Chris, for highlighting these stories. It really means a lot. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.